Thank you, Mike. I, my name is Harold, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God in the 12-step program, I found an Alcoholics Anonymous. It hadn't been necessary to take a drink since February 1970, and for that I'm very grateful. I take no credit for that. I heard one of your speakers, Scott, I think it was, said that it was by the grace of God we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's by the grace of God we stay here. And that's been my good fortune. I also want to add my commendation to Western New York service meeting this weekend. I think it's an excellent idea. I've had the very rare privilege of serving as a voting member of 8 general service conferences. I've had the privilege of serving as a general service trustee and chairman of AA World Services in New York. And I understand the value of service. It's probably one of the hallmarks of a tenure in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that people who spend their time helping others show it. When Mike talked about walking the walk and talking the talk, that's what it's about. Service is what it's about. Someone once told me that service is gratitude in motion, and I think that's what service is about. And I commend the assembly for having this meeting and giving people an opportunity to share in the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. I particularly want to thank Jerry for asking me to come up. I consider it a real privilege to be asked to speak at any gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege for me just to be here and to share in the celebration of our fellowship, because that's what it is. For many of us, when we come here, it's a measure of our gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous and the things and the great gifts that we've been given as members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's a privilege for me to be here and to share with you. I'd like to thank Cindy for picking me up at the airport and spending the day with her and Jim. We had a wonderful time. I'll tell you one thing, if you ever get to one of their meetings early, you'll get to unload a truck. But that's part of it, too. I was really happy that I was here and able to help out. I had a wonderful time this afternoon. We just had a great time just sharing and spending time with all of us. I'm also very pleased that you had an Al-Anon speaker here this afternoon. I think that Al-Anon doesn't get the recognition that they deserve. And I think that without Al-Anon, Alcoholics Anonymous would be in dire straits. We get a lot of transfers. Al-Anons have slips. You know what an Al-Anon slip is? Don't want none of you Al-Anons throwing nothing up there, that fleeting moment of compassion. I think Al-Anon, they certainly have the same problem that we have, and they certainly have the same solution, and I think they're wonderful. And I'm really very pleased that you recognize them here at your meeting. It's particularly appropriate, I think, that the service aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous is being stressed here. And it might be interesting just for information for maybe some new people to look back a little bit. It was back around 1930-31. There was a businessman who was very wealthy, very prominent man in New York, who could never get sober. He had tried everything. He had gone to all the detoxes and treatments and the psychiatrists and treatment centers in the United States. And finally, somebody recommended that he travel to Europe and visit with Dr. Carl Jung. Carl Jung was at the pinnacle of his career at that time, the most renowned psychoanalyst in the world. So this man went to Switzerland and to Bern, and he met with Carl Jung, and he spent a year with Carl. Dr. Jung, at the end of that time, told him there wasn't anything else he could do. And this person, his name was Roland, came back to New York, and within 6 months he was drunk again. He went back to Switzerland, talked to Dr. Jung, And he said, I had all the information. I thought I understood what this disease was, what this problem was, and I could take care of it. Is there anything else I could do? And Dr. Young, in spite of being one of the most prominent men in the world, was a very humble man. And he told him that he could not help him any further. With all his art and all his knowledge, he could not help him. And the man asked him, is there anything that can help me at all? And Dr. Young said, every now and then, now and again, a person recovers who has had a spiritual experience. And he said, the only time I have ever heard of anyone having a spiritual experience is a person who was so desperate that there was nothing else left for them to do. Well, at that time, there were what was known as Oxford groups. And the Oxford group movement had begun some years ago by a man named Frank Buckman. Actually, the Oxford groups began because Frank Buckman left the United States, went to England, and started a movement known as Third Century Christians. They called themselves Third Century Evangelicals. And they had four simple principles that they called absolutes. Absolute honesty, absolute love, absolute purity, and absolute unselfishness. And they took these four simple ideas, and they traveled around England, and they gathered a group of followers. And one day, someone in that group thought to themselves, perhaps we can take this message to South Africa, who was having a great deal of problems at the time. Perhaps we can take these simple ideas to South Africa and help alleviate some of the racial tensions. Well, the problem that they had was that they were a mixed race group. And because of the laws in South Africa, they weren't permitted to travel together. So they went to the government of South Africa and asked if they would be allowed to travel together. They would all travel in one railroad car. And the South African government agreed. And so in order to identify the group, they put a sign on the door, and they called it the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group traveled all over South Africa. They didn't change anything, but the name stuck. And they came back to the United States, and little Oxford groups began to spring up all over, out in Cleveland, Akron, and down on the Lower East Side. A minister named Sam Shoemaker had a mission, Calvary Mission, down on the Lower East Side, and they had an Oxford group meeting. Well, Roland came back from seeing Carl Jung and found the Oxford group. And he began to apply those simple principles, those four simple absolutes, into his life, and he got sober. And Roland remembered a guy he knew in Vermont, and his name was Ebbie Thatcher. And Ebbie was a real winner. Last time he had heard from Ebbie, Ebbie had stolen somebody's car, driven it into somebody's farmhouse, right into the kitchen, got out the car and asked the farmer's wife for a cup of coffee. And they were going to put Ebbie away forever. For some reason, Roland went, spoke to the judge, and he let Ebbie come with Roland back to the Oxford group. And Ebbie got sober. Now, it was never the intention of the Oxford group to sober up drunks. As a matter of fact, they would have preferred if drunks didn't show up at their meetings, because drunks make noise and they break stuff. But they kept showing up. Ebbie remembered a guy he used to know, a guy named Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson was living in Brooklyn, New York at the time, and he said that maybe these simple ideas could help him. He knew Bill drank a lot. So he called Bill up one day, and Bill was glad to hear from him. He hadn't heard from Ebbie for a long time. And he invited Ebbie to come over. And after he hung up the phone, he remembered Ebbie drank a lot, and he had just promoted a bottle of gin. But he invited him over anyway. And Ebbie got to the house, and Bill greeted him, and they were sitting around the kitchen table, and Bill pushed a bottle of gin across the table and offered him a drink. And Ebbie said, I'm not drinking today. And Bill was polite, and he said, are you on the water wagon? And Ebbie said, no, I got religion. Well, Bill was polite, and he said, well, what brand of religion did you get? He said, it wasn't exactly religion. He said, I met up with a group of people, and they gave me some simple ideas, and I don't have to drink anymore. And Bill was polite. He said, well, what are they? And Abby told him, he said, you get honest with yourself. You talk it out with another person. You help other people wherever you can, and you make restitution to people you may have hurt. And you pray to whatever God you might know. And he left. It wasn't too long after that that Bill wound up out in Towns Hospital the last time. And as he was walking up the steps, old Doc Silkworth was standing on the steps, and Bill said, this time I got something, Doc. This time I really got something. He was waving a bottle of gin at the time. And Dr. Silkworth said, you better go upstairs and go to bed. That night, Ebby came up again. And this time, he didn't say anything. He waited until Bill asked him. He said, Bill finally said, what was that neat little formula that you have that you don't have to drink anymore? And Ebby told him, you get honest with yourself. You talk it out with another person. You help other people wherever you can. And you make restitutions to people you may have harmed. And oh yeah, you pray to whatever God you might know. That night Bill went into his room, and he talks about this. I remember reading, I have the real rare privilege of serving on an archives committee, and I've read a lot of Bill's writings, a lot of his writings that aren't published. And he thought to himself, he was at that point that he talked about. He says that sometimes we have to go down to the depths of despair and hopelessness before we can hear the message. And he was at that point. He was at the point where he had no real God of his own understanding. He had tried everything there was. He had nothing else to do except to cry out, if there is a God, will you show yourself? And most of you have read, this is in the book, there was a blinding flash. He felt as though he was on a mountaintop with the wind rushing through. And he said, this must be the God of the preachers. And it wasn't too long after that, Dr. Silkworth came into his room. And Bill was still kind of in this state, and he asked the doctor, was he crazy? He explained what had happened. And Dr. Silkworth, being a very wise man, said, no, you're not crazy. Something has happened to you. And whatever it is, you better hold on to it, because it's much better than what you had. And it wasn't too long after that, Bill found himself out in Akron, Ohio. And you know, they say Bill was a stock broker. Bill was a stock speculator. He used to sell fast-talking to slow-thinking people is what he did. Bill thought he was going to go out to Acuren and cut this deal and take over a company. The deal fell through, and he found himself out in the hotel lobby with $10 in his pocket, gin mill at one end of the lobby, and a church directory at the other. And he's walking back and forth, and for some reason, he called up the church directory, and he got a man named Walter Tunks, who happened to be a member of the Oxford group and knew about them. Because when Bill told him he was a rum-dum from New York and he needed another drunk to talk to, under normal circumstances, most ministers would have said, you know, drunks one at a time is okay. You get two or three of them together, they're in trouble. But he perceived what Bill was saying, and he gave them a list of names, and Bill called all the people on the list, and when he got to the last person, a voice came over the phone, a woman named Henrietta Seibeling. And Henrietta said, Bill told her who he was and what he needed to do. And Henrietta said that our prayers have been answered. Bill didn't know that for many years, Dr. Bob had been going to Oxford group meetings, but he would never acknowledge that he had a drinking problem. A week before Bill showed up in Akron, Dr. Bob had gone to his Oxford group meeting and told them he had a problem with alcohol and he couldn't stop drinking. His group asked them if he wanted them to pray for him. And he said, yes, will you pray for me? A week later, Bill Wilson showed up in Akron. There are no coincidences, I believe. I don't believe that that there are any coincidences or any problematic areas that God doesn't see and understand. It took me a long time to get to that point, but I believe that today. That the real not coincidence, but the real phenomena of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe in it. There are so many different aspects of it. It just goes on and on and on, because it turns out that Roland Hazard came from Vermont, Ebby Thatcher came from Vermont, Bill Wilson came from Vermont, and Dr. Bob Smith originally came from St. Johnsbury in Vermont. And it gets even stranger than that, because I believe that our recovery process, the thing that we have such a difficult time trying to explain to other people, that phenomena of one alcoholic talking to another, really began in Bill Wilson's kitchen. I know we think of our fellowship beginning in Akron when Bill met Bob, and certainly our structure began there. But for the first time that we have recorded, one alcoholic came to another alcoholic and he heard the message. And the strange part of that is that Dr. Young understood what the solution was, but he didn't know what the problem was. Dr. Silkworth knew what the problem was, but he didn't know what the solution was. Now, the Oxford group had the problem and the solution and didn't know there was a problem. All those things had to come together, finally, around Bill Wilson's kitchen table, when Ebby told Bob what the solution was. Not only did he tell them what the solution was, he gave them a plan, program of action. For the first time, he had a plan, program of action. So I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous really began in so many different ways. I think of a giant tapestry. If you look at a tapestry on one side of it, there's a beautiful picture. But if you look behind the tapestry, you'll see 1,000 threads going 1,000 different directions. And if you pull a thread over here, the picture will change over here. You pull a thread over here, the picture will change over here. And all those threads make up the picture of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all those threads are all of you who have traveled the road to make up our fellowship. And that's the tapestry. That's the phenomenon. That's the extraordinary God consciousness of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what people don't understand and so difficult to explain. I grew up on the east side of Manhattan, on what's known as Spanish Harlem. And Spanish Harlem, you grow up real quick, so you stand a very good chance of not growing up at all. See, when I was growing up as a kid in Harlem, if somebody had told me I was going to be standing in Buffalo, New York, April 4th of 1997, talking to a bunch of junks, I'd probably shot him. I had no idea in those days what commitment were. Words like honesty and commitment and they were alien words to me. You know, you did what you had to do to get over a day at a time. I understood that concept a long time ago. You know, but I guess by today's standards, I would be considered an entrepreneur. In those days, I was a hustler. I used to find stuff before it officially got lost. If it was small enough, you just stole it. If it was too big to carry, you lay down next to it and claim it. They used to send social workers in there to study us. I never will forget. One day one of them asked me how far it was to the subway. Told them I didn't know. Nobody ever made it. You grow up in an environment like that, in my old neighborhood, you don't have the opportunity to get a lot of God consciousness. But I believe that alcoholics have a a survival mechanism that God has given us for some reason. And for some reason, we acquire certain skills and certain knowledge that when you look at it in the aggregate, it's enormous. We come to the fellowship with all kinds of skills. We have to. We have to because we're alcoholics and we're required to our stock and trade is to get over however we do it. And so when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we bring something to the table. And no matter how far down the scales we have gone, our experiences will benefit others. Our promises tell us that. And it's true. So that growing up in New York, I think what probably set me apart, and I think this is true of all alcoholics, they say that we're loners, and I don't believe that. I believe we are very private people. I believe alcoholics keep their own counsel. We know what's best for us, and we do the things that we think are best for us. And so we go about our lives staying apart. And that was me. I was growing up in the streets of New York. I was boxing, and it was good. Fighting in the streets, people left you alone, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted people to just leave me alone. I didn't want people to get too close to me, and I put this little wall out here. And anytime somebody would try to get close to me or get to understand me or get to know me, I put another brick in that wall. And somebody would try to get to know me or pay attention to me, I put another brick in the wall. And pretty soon that wall got higher and higher and higher. And I didn't realize until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that people couldn't get to me because of that wall. But I was behind the wall and I couldn't get out. And I used to run into that wall. I used to run into that wall 14 times every day before I figured out you could go around it. I love the old story you hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know all of y'all have heard it, but I'm going to tell it anyhow. There's two doors at the end of a hallway. This is the way you can tell a non-alcoholic from an alcoholic. Two doors at the end of a hallway. Over one door, there's a sign that says peace and happiness. Inside the door, there's a guy with a baseball bat. Now, the non-alcoholic will come down, walk down the hallway, walk through the door. Guy with the baseball bat will hit him right in the head. Comes out, goes across the door, across the hall, sees the door with the sign that says peace and happiness, goes right through the door and has peace and happiness for the rest of his life. The alcoholic comes down in the same two doors. He walks through the door. There's the guy with the bat, hits him right in the head. Turns around, comes back down the hallway, turns around, goes right back up the hallway, right through the same door. The guy hits him right in the head, turns around, comes back down the hallway, turns around, goes up the hallway. This time he stops, and he thinks to himself, maybe he won't be in there this time. Yeah. Maybe I can get away with it. So the alcoholic goes through the door. The guy with the bat is gone. The alcoholic goes looking for him. That was me. Hit the brick wall time after time after time until I realized you could go around. I had to figure that out. I didn't learn what I know because I have three university degrees. I learned what I know by hitting that brick wall 14 times every day. Going to college was a good thing. I don't want anybody to think that going to college wasn't good. I learned how to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. So it wasn't a total loss. I realized it was about time to come and get out of high school. And I'm going to kind of get through this because I want to try and get to something else before it gets too late. I was getting ready to get out of high school. I knew I was going to get drafted, and I didn't want to go in the Army. So I did the cool, slick thing. I joined the National Guard and immediately got federalized. And I wound up on active duty. As I wound up down in Texas, down in a place called El Paso, and I guess the Army really lost a lot of money on me. Even when they sent me overseas, they lost money on me. They started sending me to school. And I had gone to a technical high school and I understood physics and math and stuff. So they sent me to the guided missile center down in White Stone Sands in New Mexico. And I learned about guided missiles. But down there, it's right on the border of Juarez. I mean, I don't know if anybody's ever been down in that part of the United States. You can walk across the Rio Grande. And I used to get a drink called Oso Negro Gin. I never will forget it. Black Bear Gin, cost 44 cents a quart. Buddy and I were walking down a street in Mexico and breaking gin bottles on the lamppost, which the Mexican police take a very dim view of, and wound up in the Mexican jail. Now, I when I was a little kid, we used to see Errol Flynn movies, and he'd be a pirate captain, and he'd be dancing around the ship, sword fighting and whatnot. Then they catch him and throw him in the dungeons, and they'd have chains and bars and stuff on them. I thought that was make-believe until I got into a Mexican jail. The thing about it is that I had a fight coming up. I was boxing, and the fight was coming up. My CO was a fight fan, and he came and he got me out. And I think that's really the tragic of the alcoholic. We get into some of the damnedest things, and somehow we manage to get out. And never look at the bizarre things that happen to us to get us into them in the first place. And that would happen to me over and over and over again. Once they asked me to leave jail. They asked me to leave. You know, I heard people getting thrown in jail. I was thrown out. Fact. It was right here in New York State, a little town upstate New York. You're not supposed to drink in the street, and I'm sick of sitting on the curb sucking out of a wine bottle. Police pulled up and said, get in. Took me to their jail, brand new jail. Put me in a cell, laid down, lit a cigarette, fell asleep, and a mattress caught on fire. Took me out, put me up across the hall in another cell, laid down, lit a cigarette, mask, did exactly the same thing. The guy came in and said, you have to leave. We don't have any room. And they put me out. They drove me out to the edge of town and let me out. And, you know, it never occurred to me there was something bizarre about that. I just figured I got over again. Just got over again. You know, I used to hang out in saloons in New York. There was one, the old Commodore. It used to be the Hyatt is here now on 42nd Street. And I used to hang out there. And it was one of those real swanky saloons with panels and mirrors on the wall. And I would sit at the stool and look in the mirror, and I would see this suave, debonair guy looking back at me, and my fly would be open. We never see ourselves the way other people see us. Other people see us clearly. We never see ourselves. We have a disease that says there's nothing wrong with you. We have a disease that says you're okay. There's something sitting on the shoulder that says it's all right, you're okay. And we're clouded, our minds are clouded, and we never see the turmoil that swirls around us. And so we just continue on and on and on. And that's exactly what happened to me. I couldn't see for the life of me the problems that I was having. I left Texas and they sent me to another school in Alabama, Huntsville, Alabama, Redstone Arsenal. And in Alabama, they have state stores that nobody goes to. Everybody has their own still. And I used to live right next door to a guy that had his own still. He used to run off his own corn. I never will forget, one night I was driving back from the post, and I was feeling, I don't know, my alcohol told me to go back, turn around, go back. You're not supposed to make any turns on those back roads. You're supposed to go up to the jug handle and turn around. Anyway, I did all the cool, slick things, and I looked out the rear view mirror and checked, made what I considered this fantastic U-turn. And as near as I could figure out, they had to be in the trunk of my car. Because the minute I made that turn, there they were, two Alabama state troopers. And you know, it is not a good idea. I've been in law enforcement for a long time. It's not a good idea to argue with state troopers under the best of circumstances, but for me to argue with them in Alabama is insane. But I got over again. And again, it's because the perception that there was nothing wrong. Always that there's nothing wrong. And I think that as we go through our career, looking back, I can see over and over and over again that I would get into trouble and somehow I'd get out. I'd get into trouble and somehow I'd get out. And round and round and round it went. And I think that if you think of it in the broad sense, that's really all of our stories. We got into trouble, and somehow we got out. And the more trouble we got into, the more we drank. And the more we drank, the more trouble we got into. The more trouble we got into, the more we drank. And round and round and round we went. In the broad sense, that's all of our stories. We drank, and we got into trouble. It's amazing to me that for this many years, until very recently, people have never really looked at the physiology and the psychology of alcoholism. They're beginning to do it now and build up bodies of literature. But alcoholism is not new. Solomon talked about alcoholism in the book of Proverbs. I heard that the reason the pilgrims got off at Plymouth Rock is because they ran out of booze. You run out of booze, you get off wherever you're at. You know, for so many years, people have purported to help alcoholics. Actually, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence was a man named Benjamin Rush. And he wrote a treatise back in 1779 on alcoholism. One of the first. He's considered the father of psychology in the United States. And in his treatise, he said that alcoholism is a disease. And the only treatment for it is total abstinence. And that paper was lost, and that was written 300 years ago. And from that point till now, we are just beginning to begin to understand the physiology and psychology of the disease. I think that what we find, at least in my looking at alcoholism, there are so many people who have tried to find a cure or a method to treat alcoholism. And if you look back over the years, many people have done it. There was the Washingtonians. If you recall, the Washingtonians were a group very much like Alcoholics Anonymous. And they had groups very similar to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then all of a sudden, they got involved in politics, in the Civil War, in slavery. And their whole movement collapsed. And the thing about it is that they never wrote it down. They had no set of traditions. They had no guideline, no recipe book to say how it worked. And so when their movement collapsed, the whole system collapsed. There was another group. They were known as the Emmanuel groups. Mary Eddie Baker and Ernest Holmes and Emmett Fox and those folks in religious science back in the early 1920s came together, and they thought that if they could form what they considered sort of a symbiotic relationship between science and religion, that they could find a treatment for alcoholism. And for a while it worked. They had clinics. They call them nervous disorder clinics, where drunks started showing up. And people began to get treated. And then all of a sudden, the religious people began to argue with the scientific people whose method was right, who was wrong, and they argued back and forth. Finally, the whole system collapsed again. And again, they never wrote it down. They had no tradition. They had no book to say how it worked. And so when the movement fell, the alcoholics suffered. And I think that it's one of the reasons why we must be so particular and so critical when it comes to our tradition, when it comes to the things that make Alcoholics Anonymous work. And I remember as I was going through that process, looking back now, I never realized that the thing that I was trying to do most, which was what I was to stop drinking, was the thing that held me the tightest. It wasn't that I was trying to stop drinking. It was who I was that made me drink. And I had to change that. And I didn't understand any of that. I didn't understand that it wasn't alcohol. Alcohol was just a symptom. That I had to change who I was. My old sponsor used to say it all the time. It wasn't what I drank that made me what I was. It was what I was that made me drink. I had no idea that. I didn't understand that. I didn't even know that there was a process that could change that at the time. I just continued on. I came after I got out of Alabama. I did another very typical alcoholic thing. I got married. And the only reason I got married was because my brother got married. And it's true. We marry beautiful people. Alcoholics have a gift for that. We marry beautiful people. And they usually become our greatest enablers. And that's what happened to me. I married a beautiful person and went back to the old neighborhood. And the thing about it was that I always wanted to be this kind of civic person. I always wanted to be this pillar of society that people looked up to. And I had no sense of responsibility. I had no responsibility. I did not understand the sense that I could make a change, that I could do something to change who I was. I didn't have the means or the method. And my disease told me that there was nothing wrong. So I just continued on. And I think that's what happens to most of us. As we get further and further down into the throes of our alcoholism, the further down we go, the less we perceive there is a problem, because our mind becomes clouded. And I think Dr. Silkworth understood that when he first devised the concept of obsession and compulsion and how they tie together, that we first trigger the compulsion and the obsession takes over. And once that process goes in, it just goes on and on and on. And so we can never see ourselves for what we really are. And that's what happened to me. I came out of service. I got married, settled down, took an examination, wound up on New York City Police Department. and working in the streets, it was a good job, but I couldn't work comfortably because I was always drunk. That was an interesting period in my life, because I was locking people up for being drunk and they'd have to carry me in. But God moves in very mysterious ways. After I was in the street for about a year or so, I got a job inside the criminal courts on the warrant squad, and I was working inside. And I was working in the court, and I was working with people, and I don't know if anybody's ever been involved with the New York City system, but it's strange, because I used to work with judges. I worked with one in particular who used to have his own scotch imported from Scotland with his name on it. And he and I would be in his chamber sometimes all through the session, right through lunch, and then go home and leave the prisoners downstairs or send them back out to Rikers Island. People used to want to know why nobody ever got sentenced in our court. At the same time, you might imagine the problem at home was going on. By this time, I had two small children. My wife was just beside herself. She didn't know what to do. And I just continued on and on and on. And all the things that happened to alcoholics began to happen to me. I couldn't pay the bills. All those fears that we have, those nameless fears, began to creep in. I was afraid to answer the phone. I was afraid to open the mailbox. I used to get those letters in the mail with the big red letters on the outside say, pay up or die. And so I things just continued to pile up. I remember one time I was working for the city, and for some strange reason, if you have a city job, they will give you money. I went to the credit union. I was going to borrow enough money to pay off all the bills. And they actually gave me the money. And naturally, I stopped and discussed it with my financial manager, the bartender. And you imagine, nothing got paid. The problems kept piling up and piling up and piling up. And finally, it occurred to me, and if you can do this, you can take this disease to the moon. It occurred to me that it was all their fault. It was all their fault. If this job would leave me alone, these people would stop bothering me about these bills, if she stopped worrying me about shoes for the kids, it was all their fault. So I walked out of my house. Lovely home, wife, children, I just walked out. Wound up in one room, trying to find peace of mind. You see the pictures around the rooms, the alcoholic sitting on the bed, the two guys trying to talk to him. That was me. Broken lampshade and dangling light bulb, trying to find peace of mind. And I would wander around the streets. By this time, I had lost my job, walked out, and was living in one room. I would wander around the streets of, I lived in Staten Island at the time, and people would know who I was, and they didn't know I was unemployable. They thought I still worked for the city, and I would borrow money, and I would drink it up, and pretty soon I couldn't even afford the room, and I wound up out in the street. And living in the street, it's again, it's a day at a time. One day at a time. All I had to do was find some booze a day at a time. I lived under under a bridge, a railroad trestle, and we had our bottle gang under there. I don't know if any of you ever been involved with a bottle gang. That's a science all by itself. I used to come to like Lazarus and raise him from the dead. I was living in this basement, and we'd gather underneath the railroad trestle, and everybody would throw their coins in the circle and see if we could come up with that first bottle for the day. And when we got enough money, the real problem started, because we had to decide who was going to go get it. Then we had to decide who was going to go watch him. I never will forget that bottle, that basement, because it had a burn. It had an automatic burn, and every time the burner would fire, it had Handel's Messiah, the whole Hallelujah chorus. I hate the thing today. I was hallucinating. I saw Barnum and Bailey's Circus go through that basement. I remember coming to in the basement, and it was one of those times where I wasn't quite drunk and I wasn't quite sober. And I had that moment of clarity, and I looked around, and I saw I was in this filthy basement. And I came to and I said, "What are you doing here? Why are you in this basement? I come from a good family. I have a relatively good education. What are you doing here?" And I couldn't answer that. And so I did what I always did when I got in some kind of a jackpot. I was going to pray to God. But when I prayed to God, I was going to make a deal. You do this for me, and I'll do that for you. And nothing happened. At least I thought nothing happened. I understand today that God had never left me. God was with me all the time. That I had turned away from God. And I believe today it was in that basement that God began to lead me to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a chapter in Ecclesiastics. It says, "For everything there is a season, for every purpose there is a for everything there is a purpose under the heaven. There is a time to live and a time to die." And I believe that God will not permit us to go beyond a certain point. I believe there is a line somewhere that God will not permit us to go below. And I believe that we all reach that point sometime. And when some of us reach that point, we die. And when some of us reach that point, we find our way to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Walter Benton has a writing that's one of my favorites, because it describes what happens to the alcoholic. Curiously enough, he's writing about love, but it's exactly the same process, because he says, "Our days are of time and hours, and as the clock hand turns, a circle closes in upon us, and a black timeless night sucks us in like quicksand and receives us totally without a rain check or a parachute or a key to heaven or a last long look." That's what happens to the alcoholic. We are sucked down and down and down. And then for some inexplicable reason, some reason that no one has ever been able to fathom, God plucks some of us out. Takes some of us out and sets us into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've long since tried to give up understanding why that was, why God chose some of us and not the others. I can only explain in something that Aldous Huxley once wrote. He said that Alcoholics Anonymous was the greatest movement of the 20th century, but he also said that God always chose the least of them to show the others the way. And God chose the alcoholic, who is truly the least of them, to show the others the way. And so he gave us a particular gift that no one else has. This phenomenon of one alcoholic talking to another and hearing what we have to say. That happened to the basement, and I realized that all in hindsight, because at the time I didn't realize any of it. I was still out there, still down on the balls on my back, and I didn't know anything. For some strange reason, I had managed to hang on to my chauffeur's license, and I had a job running dumps back and forth. And one day I blacked out, and I almost ran the truck off the road into the river, but it stopped in time, and the cops came and got the thing back up on the road, but they suggested I go get a x-ray. And so I did, and forgot about it. The next day I was sitting around with some golf colleagues of mine, and we had just promoted a bottle of wine. And I get this phone call that said I had to come to the hospital where I had those x-rays taken. And they said I had to come right away. Well, I explained to this lady I had just invested my money in this wine. I wasn't about to go nowhere. But she said that if you don't come down, we're going to send the cops out and get you. And I did not need cops coming to look for me. So without making a long story longer, I went down there. It turns out I had tuberculosis. And I had it so severely, they would not let me go back home. They shipped me out to the isolation ward way out in a place called CU Hospital, Kippen of Staten Island. Stayed out there the next year and a half. One of the things about having tuberculosis is that you're flat on your back. They won't let you up. They even take you to the bathroom in a wheelchair. So for a year and a half, I lay flat on my back, and the only thing I could do was think and look back over my life. And I saw in the hospital every single time that I got into any difficulty. Every single time I lost a job or went to jail or got into a fight or anything bad ever happened to me, I was either drinking or I was drunk. And it happens from the time I was a little kid. And I think in the hospital, the cement block up here lifted and the message went through. There's something wrong with you. And it has to do with alcohol. Now, I don't know about y'all, but nobody came running down the hospital ward with a donut and a cup of coffee and say, hey, we got AIDS. Didn't happen. I went back out in the street. But I do remember the night I was about to leave. I didn't want to leave. I did not want to go out of the hospital. While I was in the hospital, I was in a protected environment. Everything was done for me. I knew the moment I left the hospital and went back out into the street, I'd be on that rat race again. I'd be running twice as fast to stay exactly where I was. And I was afraid. I had become friendly with the supervising nurse, not knowing that she was one of you sneaky people and was watching all my shenanigans in the hospital. And she came to me that night, the night before I was to leave, and asked me what was wrong. I was sitting on the side of the bed, very quiet and subdued, which is not my normal state. And I told her, for the first time, I think, of grace ever enter into my consciousness, I told her I was afraid, that I didn't want to go back out there. And I told her why. And she asked me, I guess everybody's been asked this question in one form or another. Everybody that's ever come to Alcoholics Anonymous has been asked, do they really want help? And she asked me, did I really want help? And I told her I did. And I really meant I wanted help. Turns out that she was in AA. And she arranged to get me to my first meeting. And I walked into the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous down in the old Snug Harbor group in Staten Island. And that was down at the tip end of Staten Island. And Staten Island is where the John Birch Society started. And they got people in that end of Staten Island who think the John Birch Society are liberals. You see. I walked in to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, and I knew something was wrong. First, there weren't any black people in there. The second thing was I saw guys in there wearing white socks in the wintertime. I knew that there was something wrong. And the guy walked up to me. The guy would become my sponsor. Ellie, I call him my walking stick. God bless him. He passed on a few years back, and I really miss him. He walked up to me, and he showed me this blue book. And he said, everything that you will ever need is in this book. And my scheme in mind went right to work. I figured that if everything I ever needed is in this book, maybe I could read this book and figure out how to get a loan out of these people. So I read the book. I read it from cover to cover. came back and I said, Ellie, I can't get a loan out of this book. He said, yes, you can. And he was right. Everything I have ever needed, I found between the covers of Alcoholics Anonymous in one form or another. And we began that journey that we've all been on. We've all been on. And what he told me was, we're not interested in who you are. We're going to find out who you are not. We're going to get rid of all of that, and who you are will show up. And we began to work on things. And he began to explain to me. He explained to me what exactly it was we were going to do. And as foggy as I was, as dense as I was, as mocus as we are when we first walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't that I understood what he was saying, but for some reason, I trusted what he was saying. I believed what he was saying to me. And he would say to me, like, we're going to build an arch. And when that arch is completed, you're going to be able to step through it into the sunlight of the Spirit. I thought he was crazy. Sunlight of the Spirit. I couldn't pay the rent. But he was right. What he said was that for some reason, our spirit has gone to sleep. Alcoholic spirits have long lain dormant. And it's because we have built up these series of blocks in front of us. And what we have to do is remove those blocks one at a time. And when all the blocks are removed, the sunlight can come in. I didn't understand it, but I believed him. And we began to go through that process, through that recovery process, a step at a time. And as we went through it, he would explain every single thing that we were about to do, so that it wasn't mysterious. It wasn't a magical. It was a simple process that at the end of it, we will get certain results if we follow it. Follow it the way it's suggested to us. I have learned the mirror of truth is where I learned my greatest lesson when it's held in front of me. I also learned that truth without love is cruel, and that confrontation without a solution is worthless. And what I discovered as I was going through the recovery process with Ellie was that I had to look at the truth of myself, but I had to look at it with love and compassion. And I did that, and as I did that, there was a solution. It wasn't a meaningless confrontation with the truth. There was a solution. And as I walked through each of the steps, and as I looked at myself over and over again, I discovered that I was not only a spiritual being having a human experience, that I was a perfect child of God, and that nothing could ever change that. I found out that there is no reality apart from God. I found that in that process. I believe when Bill says that the great reality is really deep down within each and every one of us, and when he says that we need to do three things to find it, we need to rid ourselves of all bias, think honestly, and look inside ourselves diligently, and the power will emerge. That's exactly what happened. When we remove those blocks, those things that he calls faults or wrongs or defects of character, whatever they are, when we remove those, the great power will emerge. And the power is awesome. God once told me, nobody can give you power. Power is something you have to take. And the power is inside of us to take. All we have to do is reach inside. I believe that justice is a byproduct of self-respect. And I believe that the self-respect we find as we begin to understand the truth of ourselves will allow us to demand the justice that we need as we go forward. And all the things that we have to do to correct, all the relationships we have to rebuild, we can look at the truth of ourselves without fear, with love and compassion, and understand the justice of what we're doing. it's such a total involvement, a total environment that we're involved with in our recovery process that we almost miss it. And when we look at it, we find that the bottom line, the real thing, the thing that Dr. Bob said, that in the final analysis, what it's all about is love and service. What he's really saying is when we finally get to the end, when we finally get to what we find is our spiritual awakening, what we find is what God's will was all the time. God's will for us was to be happy. Simple. That's all we're doing. He lays out a process for us to be happy, to find joy. He wrote it down in the book of Galatians. He said that, behold, the fruits of the Spirit is joy. Bill Wilson has laid out a process for us to be happy. Now, alcoholics will work very hard at screwing that up. Not God's fault, not AA's fault. He's laid out a perfect process for us to be happy. And so as we go through that recovery process and we look to ourselves in each one of those steps, we find what he intended. And that's what happened to me. I remember as we were going through the steps that got me to the point where I realized that it wasn't shooting crap anymore. I got to the point where I had to say what it was all about. I had done this inventory business. I had looked at myself. There wasn't any way I could play tricks in my head. I wrote down who I was, what I was, and I told it to somebody else. There wasn't any mistake about who I was. Did I want to still be that same person? Or did I want to change? I had to make that decision. And Ellie made it real simple for me. He said, you can't change anything. All you can do is ask and be willing. He said that a farmer can't grow anything. A farmer can plant the seeds and water the soil and till the land. God will make the plants grow. A doctor can't heal anybody. He can diagnose the illness. He can prescribe the medication. God will heal the patient. What we do is set up the condition. The farmer sets up the condition. The doctor sets up the conditions. What we do is set up the conditions where the change can take place. And all we really have to do is ask. And the change began to take place. And I think that the power of Alcoholics Anonymous as that change takes place is awesome. It will work for everybody. I love to see when women come to Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly. Women, for some reason in our system, we have this double standard, this double kind of system where a man can go out and get drunk and lay down and roll around in the gutter all day and get up the next day, put on a shirt and a tie and go out, and nobody really thinks much about it. But if a woman does exactly the same thing, for some reason she's marked. For some reason there's a difference. She's different. She's marked. She's tainted. Men have never really considered women's issues. It's almost as if there's a demon on their shoulders that tells women there's something wrong with them, that they're less than, they have no worth. I remember somebody said, can you kill the demon? And the answer is no, you can't kill the demon, but you can educate him. You can educate him right off your shoulder. And that's what happens when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You can educate the demon right off their shoulder. And we say to people, women and everyone else, let us love you so you can love yourself. Let us show you that you are a perfect child of God, that nothing can change that. No matter what you think or what you feel, you are still a perfect child of God and nothing will change that. And when you realize that, you begin to see the light come on and the smile. And they're smiling from in here, not with their teeth. And I think that the power of Alcoholics Anonymous begins to show through in every single aspect of our lives. As I got through with the process, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, as you might imagine, things had not gone well at home for me. My wife had contracted cancer, and she had died. My children were in foster care. And I had the unique problem of finding my two children where they were in foster care. I prayed to God to help me find my children. And my old sponsor used to say, be careful what you pray for, because when God really wants to punish you, he will answer your prayer. See? And he gave me back my two children, two teenage boys that I raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're both in AA now. And that was another story in all itself, raising them through all the trials and tribulations of raising two teenage boys. And all the benefits and the gifts, Alcoholics Anonymous wrapped their arms around me, and I managed to get through all of that. And it is the power of our fellowship. The power is in our all of our midst. In our individual and collective midst, there is a power that sort of precipitates out over us and sprinkles down, and we feel it every time we come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in here now. And it's because of the process that we follow. I never forget, my sponsor used to tell stories, and he would tell the story about this teacher. And he wanted, he had a class, and he wanted to teach the class about the meaning of life. So he took a pitcher out, and he took a box of rocks, and he filled the box with rocks. And he asked the class, can anything else get in it? And the class said, no. He took out some gravel, and he filled in the cracks of the rocks with the gravel, filled it up. Then he asked the class, can anything else get in the pitcher? And by this time, they were on to him, and nobody said nothing. He took out a pitcher of sand, and he poured sand on top of the gravel, and he filled the pitcher up to the top with the sand. And then he said, can anything else get in the pitcher? Nobody said anything. He took out a pitcher of water, and he poured the water in the pitcher and filled the pitcher full with water. And then he asked the class, what's the meaning of the story? And somebody said, the meaning of life is that you can always add more. And the teacher said, no, the meaning of life is you have to put the rocks in first. You don't put the rocks in first, you can't get nothing else in afterwards. If you don't do the process the way it's laid out, it won't work down the road. So they've given us this simple process. If we follow it, 3 through 11, 12 will occur. And it occurs in so many strange ways and so many different ways in my life, it's impossible to talk about. I remember my mother was very ill. She had diabetes. Most difficult thing I had to do was to give permission to have her leg amputated. But then I had the even more difficult thing to do was go and tell her that I had given her permission to amputate her leg. And I did. And I held her hand as we went into the operating room. And I told her I loved her and I meant it. And I told her it would be all right. And even after, some time after which she passed on, I know she was in a better place. And all the time I had the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous had closed in around me. And I had all the love and feeling that I needed to get me through that. We can walk through fire, and I've seen people do that. We can walk through fire. Somebody said we've been given the opportunity to walk into a new land. And even though that new land is fraught with pit holes and obstacles, we have the steps to step on and take us through it. And I know exactly what the preacher meant when he said he had been to the mountaintop and looked over into the promised land, because we're there. We're there. We're in the promised land. And I think that what is the challenge, particularly as you people are service people, to carry our message, to carry it forth, is probably the most important and critical aspect of the continuance of our fellowship, particularly at service, in service. And while service can mean a great many things, service means that you have made a commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, a commitment that we're going to do what's necessary to keep Alcoholics Anonymous moving forward. I'm going to give you all my gifts and get sit on down from here. I go around. I travel around a lot. Last week I was in Massachusetts. Next week I'm going to be in Albany. And everywhere I go, I always say the same thing. I hope I see all of you all over the road somewhere. I go to a lot of meetings. And if you ever get down to Annapolis, Maryland, my home group is Back to Basics, Monday night, Back to Basics. We meet on Monday. Happens to be the best group in AA. And once I was out to Minot, a little town out in Minnesota, North Dakota. And there's a group of Indians. They're Chippewa Indians, and they have a sweat lodge in a place called Turtle Mountain. And it's called Turtle Mountain Chippewa. And I was out there, and I go out there frequently, and the elders told the story, and they tell the story every time we're out there at a sweat lodge. And the story is about the wounded healer. And the wounded healer is a spirit. It's a spirit guide. And she's a woman. And the wounded healer doesn't do anything. But when the Indian warrior is wounded, the wounded healer appears in front of the warrior and opens her cloak. And she has a wound exactly the same as the warrior. And the warrior looks at her wound, and he gets healed. And that's exactly what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every time we share our strength, our hope, and our experience, we show somebody our wound. And when they see our wound, they get healed. And so we are all wounded healers. And I think the great challenge that we all face is to take that knowledge and that gift and do as Bill Wilson said, pass it on. Thank you very much.